speak about thermality of spherical causal domains and the entanglement spectrum.
Hello, everyone. Thank you very much for being here. This is work in collaboration with Eugenio Bianchi, and we just began this this summer in Zakopane at the wonderful Krakow School for Theoretical Physics. Next slide. And let me ask if you can hear me.
Yes, go ahead.
Excellent. So one of the entry points to the work that we've done, and I think a nice way of thinking about it, is that entanglement leads to even finite regions of space-time being hot. So this is like the Unruh effect, except in a finite region of space-time. And I call this an entry point because we have several results that I'll talk about, but I think this is a really nice way to organize how you think about this result. In particular, we'll illustrate this claim with a spherical entangling surface. So the region will be spherical in shape. Next slide. So entanglement is gaining more and more importance in the study of quantum fields, and I wanted to tell you about some of the recent results that I think are of interest for all of us. For the topic of this talk today, in particular, Cassini, Huerta, and Rob Myers have been working extensively on a spherical causal domains. So they've derived many, many results, in particular pertaining to the entanglement entropy of this domain. And one way of viewing the talk today is as providing a relativist perspective on this work. Entanglement entropy has also been playing a larger and larger role in the study of black holes. Eugenio has provided a number of interesting insights. In particular, he's shown that you can recover the Bekenstein-Hawking entropy or its variation through looking at entanglement entropy, and also seen that you can derive Bekenstein-Hawking from spin foams this way. John Merrill is using entanglement to look at holography without strings. And I think this is interesting for all of us because he relies heavily on entanglement and on the gravitational Gauss law. And then finally, I just want to mention some recent work that Eugenio Carlo and I have done on the on Lee Smolin's wonderful idea of the disappearance of the distinction between statistical and quantum fluctuations. And we've shown that in the context of general surfaces in space-time, you can once again recover this idea by thinking about the entanglement between these surfaces. So entanglement is an interesting window into quantum gravity. Much of this talk, I will be focusing on quantum field theory, but the aim is really to shed light on spin networks and loop gravity. So I'll talk about that extensively towards the end of the talk. Next slide. So I want to give some what I call boundary conditions for the talk. These are the conventions that I'll follow throughout. In particular, for simplicity, I'll restrict to a scalar field, which is massless in 3 plus 1 dimensional space-time. And I'll take the mostly plus metric signature. But everything that I speak about will apply to a general conformal field theory. So this restriction is just to keep everything understandable. Next slide. So the outline is that I'd like to tell you the kind of entanglement that I'm thinking about. I'd like to tell you the where and the when of the region. And I'd like to explain why we might be interested in the entanglement spectrum. So let me begin with this first part discussing the kind of entanglement. So if we consider a partition of a Hilbert space into two pieces, I'll call them the A and the B pieces, and a pure state within this tensor product decomposition of the total Hilbert space. We can always use the Schmidt decomposition of this pure state, which expresses it as a superposition of tensor product states where IA and IB are orthonormal bases in each of the factor Hilbert spaces. In particular, we can trace out part of the Hilbert space. Here I trace out the A Hilbert space. And we can look at the reduced density matrix. And this can also be expressed in terms of this Schmidt decomposition. So on the next slide, I show that the entanglement entropy can be written as a von Neumann entropy for this reduced density matrix, that is, as trace rho log rho. And I illustrate this with a very simple example, a sort of maximally entangled state. And you see that the entanglement entropy simply codes what's called the Schmidt rank here, the number of summons in this entangled state. So the takeaway here is that we're interested in bipartite entanglement of pure states. However, the entanglement entropy is only a single number, and so it encodes a very limited amount of information about this entanglement. And we might be interested in a richer characterization of the entanglement. So on slide 7, we notice that the density matrix, because it's positive definite, can always be written as the exponential, as an exponential of an entanglement Hamiltonian. And in fact, the Schmidt decomposition discussed above provides a diagonalization of this Hamiltonian immediately. And we call the eigenvalues of entanglement Hamiltonian the entanglement spectrum. Is there a question? Okay, if not, I'll proceed. The entanglement spectrum was introduced within the condensed matter literature by Lee and Haldane just 5 years ago. So in the condensed matter literature, they've been using this extensively. In particular, you can identify symmetries of the underlying conformal field theory using the degeneracy of the entanglement spectrum. And this degeneracy can show up in the entanglement spectrum, even though it doesn't show up in the physical spectrum of the conformal field theory. So this has been used to study Hall states and for particular values of the entanglement spectrum is also applicable to topological insulators. So here I'm interested in seeing what we can learn about space-time fields by looking at this entanglement spectrum, which in principle provides a much more thorough understanding of the entanglement. So that's all I have to say about the entanglement. This is a good place for any questions, if there are any. All right, so let me tell you about the region of space-time that we're interested in, slide 8. And then on slide 9, I introduce this region. So the region is a ball in space. So you can think of this as a basketball, and I mean a three ball. So it's both the skin of the basketball and its interior. And we're going to look at the Cauchy development of this three ball. That is the intersection between all the points that this region can affect and all the points that affect this region. So in a TXY section, this is the double cone pictured in the middle of the slide 9. In particular, the ball is the greenish-yellow middle part of this region. The entangling surface is the boundary of this ball, so it's the skin of the basketball, and it's a two-sphere. And most often I'll picture this in a TX section, where the causal diamond is pictured. The ball is the central line segment, and the boundary sphere is just the two blue dots at the edge of that line segment. In particular, I'm going to choose adapted coordinates that preserve this two-sphere. So by preserve, I mean that they fix the two-sphere in the same way that polar coordinates fix the origin of the plane. So let me explain that in more detail on slide 10. Here we see that you can slice up a causal diamond by using hyperbolas. So I'm going to take both the spatial slices, which are hyperbolas, and time-like slices, which are hyperbolas, and introduce coordinates along these hyperbolas. So the time-like coordinate will be called lambda, and it flows from negative infinity at the bottom tip of the diamond to plus infinity at the top tip of the diamond, and a radial-like coordinate sigma, which goes from zero at the center of the diamond out to plus infinity at the right tip of the diamond, pictured here. And then these will be extended to full four-dimensional coordinates using the standard spherical theta and phi. In these coordinates, the Minkowski metric is rather simple. It becomes a conformal rescaling, an overall factor times the standard Friedman-Robertson-Walker metric. This is a spatial curvature of negative 1 FRW metric, and it's static. That is, it doesn't have its own scale factor, or rather, its scale factor is 1. So another thing that's clear in this metric is that the d by d lambda vector field is a killing vector of the FRW metric. And since our Minkowski metric is just a conformal rescaling of this FRW metric, we see that d by d lambda is just a conformal killing vector of the diamond. So I'll use that fact later. So far, these coordinates only cover the interior of the diamond. And you may be wondering, what about the rest of Minkowski space? So on slide 11, I show that this coordinate system can actually be extended to the whole of Minkowski space. So on the upper right, I have a conformal diagram. The diamond region that we've been discussing is the central region 1 of this conformal diagram. And the coordinates of the previous slide cover that region. But a simple modification of those coordinates covers, for example, region 2. And I've given the formulas at the left. And in the bottom left, I've shown the coordinate curves for all of the Minkowski spacetime. So it's fairly straightforward to show that these hyperbolas are all asymptotically null. So in particular, that means that, and this is illustrated in the bottom right conformal diagram, it means that these are not, in general, Cauchy slices. They go out and they meet scry minus, for example, or scry plus. The only one of these surfaces, these spatial slices, which is a Cauchy slice, is the lambda equals zero central slice. Okay, before we go on, are there any questions about these coordinates? All right, in slide 12, I investigate various limiting cases of these coordinates to see how they compare with standard coordinate systems. In the large sigma limit, so this is large radius, the coordinates reduce, the coordinate transformation reduces to the transformation to the Rindler wedge. And in particular, we're able to identify the proper distance from the right corner. And I call this proper distance script L. And it's simply related to the coordinate sigma. So in the turquoise region at the right, these coordinates become Rindler coordinates. Similarly, in the lambda goes to negative infinity limit, the metrics can be simplified, and we see that it becomes the Milne universe. So this is standard Minkowski space, but foliated by hyperbole, and was studied early on by Milne as a sort of cosmological model. You can see that the Milne universe metric is, again, FRW, but this time with a scale factor of capital T squared. So these diamond coordinates yield well-known models in the limits of going to the corners of the diamond. Okay, let's use these coordinates.
Can I ask a question?
Yes.
I'm confused about what you mean by the Rinder wedge. Not normally, the Rinder horizons are not compact. Right? Here, you're looking at the H2 cross R kind of boundaries, right? I'm confused about the terminology.
So,
four dimensions, Rinder wedges are not compact, right? And the boundaries are not compact.
Yes, indeed. So, I'm saying that in the limit of large sigma, these coordinates are just like the coordinates of the Rindler wedge. So, so the slicing, while it looks hyperbolic over the whole diamond, in the limit of going very close to this this tip, this right tip, they look like flat slices coming out of that corner.
Thank you.
On slide 13, I introduce a current. So this current is built out of the stress energy tensor, T mu nu, and the congruence d by d lambda. And we can look at the divergence of this current. And using conservation of stress energy, the first part drops out. And then using the symmetry of the stress energy tensor, we notice that this the divergence can be written in terms of the killing derivative of xi. But as we noticed a few slides back, xi is a conformal killing vector. And so the conformal killing equation says that that killing derivative is proportional to the metric. So putting that into this divergence, we see that the divergence of this current is proportional to the trace of the stress energy tensor. So in particular, if we focus on field theories that are dilatationally invariant, that is, they have a dilatation scale symmetry, those field theories have a traceless stress tensor, at least on shell, that is, on the solutions of the classical equations of motion. And so this current, it becomes conserved. That is, this current is another current for such theories. So we'll use this current on the next slide to construct a conserved charge. We simply integrate the current over one of the spatial slices of this decomposition of the diamond that we were just studying. And this conserved charge will generate the foliation that I've been discussing. In particular, I give an explicit expression for the charge at the bottom of the slide. On the lambda equals zero slice, it can be seen as an integral over the ball using the standard volume element of the ball times a conformal factor times an expression that's quadratic in the field. So this charge is very simple and generates the evolution that we've been discussing. All right. So let's turn to the entanglement spectrum. On slide 16,
I have an elementary confusion. I thought in the beginning you were looking at a massless scalar field in four dimensional Minkowski space, right?
Yes.
So why is it stress and intensity divergence free in that case?
So this is a massless because the scalar field is conformal in the massless limit.
No, it's in four dimensions, not right. I'm confused. Sorry.
It's traceless. The stress energy tensor is traceless.
In four dimensions, I'm just confused about elementary things. Stress energy tensor is just given by grad A phi grad B phi minus 1/2 GAB times grad C phi grad C phi. If I take its trace, I don't get zero, right?
It's zero on shell. That's important. You have to use the equations of motion to show that the trace is zero.
And I'm very confused because the trace is just given by some number. It's just equal to minus This is minus grad C phi, grad C phi. And on the equation of motion, this is not zero, right? I'm confused about the elementary thing, but I mean, in two space-time dimensions, it is true. But in higher dimensions, it's not true, right?
It's a consequence of the scale invariance that the trace of the stress energy tensor vanishes.
Right, and if you use... But action is scale invariant in two dimensions, but not in higher dimensions, right? Because action is a GAB upstairs, grad A phi times grad B phi. So under conformal rescalings, GAB changes, and then you've got a... And of course, you've got also square root of the determinant. The two change, and...
I'm not talking about a general... I'm not talking about a general conformal rescaling that's position dependent. I'm just talking about a constant dilatation, a constant rescaling, and the action is invariant under that.
But do you agree that the stress energy tensor is just given by GAB equal to grad A phi, grad B phi, minus 1/2 times grad C phi contracted? Okay, let's just discuss it later.
Okay. So on slide 16, I recall something that's familiar to this audience, namely, you can reconstruct the Minkowski vacuum as a Euclidean path integral over the lower half space. So with the boundary condition that the field vanishes at infinity. In a very similar manner, you can get the density matrix, for example, of the Rindler spacetime, the right Rindler slice, as a Euclidean path integral where you wick rotate the boost parameter into a rotation angle. And you integrate over all of space-time, again, with the boundary condition of zero at infinity. And this gives the standard density matrix, e to the negative 2 pi times the boost Hamiltonian. In a very similar manner, you can construct the density matrix for this spherical region. We wick rotate again. Lambda goes into a Euclidean angle, lambda e. And as you evolve... this lambda e is a coordinate of a standard orthonormal coordinate system, the bipolar coordinate. And these bipolar coordinates are circles around these two centers, which are the tips of the left and right tips of the diamond. So by evolving in 2 pi of lambda e, you can do a path integral over all of Minkowski space outside of this central interval, and you find that the reduced density matrix for our ball region is e to the negative 2 pi times Cn. So this gives us the density matrix. Slide 17. So right away, you'll recognize that this density matrix is a thermal density matrix and satisfies the KMS condition. And so just as in the Rindler case, we can associate a geometric temperature to this density matrix. This is a dimensionless temperature of 1 over 2 pi. However, to get the standard Unruh result from the geometric temperature, we know that we have to introduce what an actual observer along one of the Rindler trajectories would observe. And so we introduce a scaling of this geometric temperature by d eta, the boost parameter, by d tau, the proper time. In a very similar manner, you can introduce a temperature for the diamond as this geometric temperature times d lambda d tau. And I've recorded the metric here again for you. And you can see that this d lambda d tau just contributes a factor, a conformal factor to the temperature, or an inverse conformal factor, if you like. So the contour plot just below the formula shows this temperature over the diamond region. Cool colors are lower temperatures, and hot colors are higher temperatures. And you see that this temperature diverges near the boundaries of the diamond. But in particular, because the conformal factor vanishes nowhere, the temperature is non-zero throughout the entire region. So even though it's a cool color in the center, the temperature is non-zero there. This means if you think back to the slicing of the diamond that we were looking at before, the central observer was just an inertial observer. He just moves straight along the line from the bottom tip to the upper tip. And so this is an inertial observer, and this temperature would be non-zero for this inertial observer. So this is not the usual notion of temperature that we would think of measuring operationally with a thermometer. So let me introduce a third notion of temperature. This might be called the Unruh temperature, or thermometer temperature for this diamond region. As we've been discussing, the diamond is foliated by these hyperbolic slices. And these, as they're hyperboles, these are also hyperbolas. These are also constant acceleration trajectories. And so the thermometer temperature, if we repeat Unruh's sort of two-state thermometer construction along one of these trajectories, the thermometer would measure an acceleration over 2 pi, temperature of A over 2 pi. So in particular, if the region is large enough, this would thermalize at that temperature, this thermometer. And in particular, the central trajectory would have zero temperature in this Unruh notion. So the thermometer really measures the coupling between the stress energy tensor C and U, where C is a killing vector and U is the observer's velocity. So the Martinetti-Rovelli temperature, in a sense, because it couples to the conformal killing vector, is different from what we standardly mean by a thermometer. So the real takeaway that I want you to have from this slide is that the notion of temperature and the thermodynamics of the region is non-trivial, and there's not a clear operational meaning to the most sort of geometrically obvious temperature, which is this Martinetti-Rovelli temperature. And this temperature has been reintroduced a number of times. Recently, Wang et al. Viewed this as an entanglement temperature, this type 2 one, because it's clearly hot near the boundary of the region where there's the highest entanglement. So there's not a uniform notion of temperature here, and I'm taking this as a spur to investigate more deeply what the entanglement of this region is, rather than just characterizing it by an entropy or by a temperature. And finally, as a sort of side comment that's interesting, this region is not clearly in equilibrium despite satisfying the KMS condition. As I've said, these are Unruh trajectories that we've been investigating, but they're not packed into this diamond in the same way that they're packed into the Rindler wedge. So that means that if they were to radiate from one to another, they wouldn't obviously be in thermal equilibrium with one another. In the Rindler case, the radiation is adjusted by exactly the factor that you need to get the Tolman relationship. While in this diamond, they've been repacked, and so they won't be in obvious equilibrium with one another. So Goffredo Chirco and Carlo and I have been investigating more general notions of equilibrium and covariant systems, and this may be an interesting system to look at. But for now, let's continue to focus on the entanglement aspect.
It seems to me that you're using the terms in somewhat different language, because Unruh observers are following always killing vectors. It's not just constant acceleration. I mean, there are many trajectories of constant acceleration, but the Unruh effect comes because these objects are these observers are following killing trajectories. And your observers, when you call about undue temperature, they're of course not following killing trajectories because, you know, the boost killing vector doesn't leave with any diamond invariant. So it seems to me that you're sort of using terminology in different sense than what is in the literature. Is this correct?
Yes, you could say that. In fact, what I think, the way I like to say it is that in the Rindler wedge case, several things kind of coincide. So one of the things that I think this diamond example is very nice for is to sort of split degeneracies that we may not have been aware of previously. So as you're saying, the constant acceleration observers agree with the killing observers in the Rindler case, while the constant acceleration observers don't in this case. Nonetheless, I think I'm using it in a sensible fashion. The point is that you could repeat exactly Unruh's argument about two-state detectors, and you would find that that detector thermalizes along these trajectories if the region is large enough for that thermalization to take place. And so this really is a natural sort of operational sense of this temperature.
What does it mean to say that the region is large enough for thermalization to take place? I mean, this region is just a region, a wedge in the Minkowski space, and nothing physical is happening, right? You just cut it out. So what does it mean that the region is large enough for thermalization?
I mean that if you turn on your detector at the lower tip of the diamond, there's going to be transient. There's going to be effects of the fact that you turned it on just then. So I just mean that there's a long enough, you don't reach the other end of the diamond before those transients have died off. That's what I mean.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. So I'd like to understand this entanglement at a deeper level. And to do that, I'm going to leverage this conformal symmetry that we're assuming this field has. So here I've written out the curved space-time Lagrangian that we were discussing before. And now I will consider a position-dependent conformal transformation. So the barred metric is omega squared times the unbarred metric. And at the same time as transforming the metric, I'll also transform the field. So the barred field is an inverse conformal factor times the unbarred field. For the massless action, the action is invariant under this transformation if there's a special coupling, C, to the Ricci scalar here. So this C has to be 1/6, or the theory won't be conformally invariant. In the special case that the barred metric is just the flat space-time metric, the equation of motion transforms in a very simple manner. The barred D'Alembertian acting on the barred field is a conformal factor to the minus 3 times this expression on the right. So I'm going to use this simple transformation law to extract the modes in this diamond. I do this on slide 19. Sorry, can you move closer to the microphone? I can't hear you.
Can you hear me here?
Yes.
Yeah, I just want to go back on the slide to the remark by Abai. You see here the fact that you have to transform the field pi bar is the sign that the trace of the energy momentum tensor does not vanish for scalar field in four dimensions. So, you know, because in two dimensions, you would not have to rescale the field. So that's the key point, I think, that Abai was making earlier.
So,
Hal, could you repeat the question?
So, Laurent was
Maybe if you understood, you can tell.
Laurent was asking again about this tracelessness of the stress energy tensor. In the literature, this is often referred to as the improved stress energy tensor. it's true that it's not manifestly traceless, but after you use the equations of motion, you find that it is indeed traceless.
Okay, we can. I don't think the equations of motion make, you know, can be used because you don't have any box phi in the trace sensor. You just have d phi square. But so the trace of the energy tensor is just proportional to d phi square, and you cannot use the equations of motion unless the field is a single mode field, field. But otherwise.
So when you use this improved stress energy tensor, which is just the standard stress energy tensor modified by the equations of motion, it is indeed always traceless.
It is not.
It's a simple construction. I'd be happy to go through it another time.
But could you just tell us what the modified stress energy tensor would be, just in Minkowski space, right? I mean, just rewrite it in Minkowski space, and we can see if it's traceless.
Yes. So in Minkowski space, so what it does is it, so again, if we use this conformal coupling value, C equals 1/6, all it does is it modifies the coefficients of the various terms. So the relevant term is the last term, and it ends up being 1/12 instead of 1/3. I don't know that I have the expression memorized.
I have a question.
Yes.
It's just a comment, but I think he's right in the fact that the stress tensor in Minkowski is traceless. And a simple way of realizing is that we know that in curved spacetimes, if we have a massless scalar field with conformal coupling to the curvature, so 1 over 6 of the coupling, we know that the field is conformal invariant and the trace is identically zero. So if you take the stress tensor and you use the equations of motion, as he says, one can show that the trace is identically zero. But in Minkowski spacetime, because of the curvature is equal to zero, any coupling is like a conformal coupling. So as a consequence of conformal invariant, the stress tensor is also zero in Minkowski spacetime for any coupling.
If you rescale the field, which is that you have another contribution, that's not the contribution you get by varying the metric or rescaling the metric. So, I mean, what he means is that, he's using a scalar field is globally conformal invariant, which means that the integral of the trace of the stress tensor vanish. That is true, but so the integral vanish, but the stress tensor just doesn't. I mean, it's a one-line computation. I'm sorry. But let's move on.
We can go on. I completely agree with Laurent, but we can go on. I mean, it's a one-line calculation. I agree. Okay, let's just go on.
All right. So we'll use this transfer. I'm on slide 19. We'll use transformation property of the equations of motion, with the barred metric being the flat spacetime metric, and the unbarred metric will be. I'm sorry. There's a typo here. The unbarred metric should just be the FRW metric without the conformal factor. So the conformal factor is going to come into the relationship between these two metrics. So we can solve the unbarred metric, which is, as I've said, hyperbolic FRW. And this is done by separation of variables. So we find the modes as the products of a time function, chi, radial function pi, and the standard spherical harmonics. The pi's satisfy a polynomial equation, sort of standard polynomial equation, where n is a normalization factor. And the chi's in the static FRW case are simple functions. So this allows us to solve for the sphere modes, the modes in the barred metric in these unusual coordinates, just by conformally rescaling the FRW modes. So our modes are given at the bottom of slide 19. Okay. So on slide 20, I turn to the definition of a sphere vacuum and the associated particle. So in the Minkowski case, the standard thing is to decompose the field into creation and annihilation operators times the modes. And then the vacuum satisfies the condition that it's annihilated by all of the annihilation operators. So the idea would to be to introduce a new vacuum, which cuts out all of the entanglement between the interior of the sphere and its exterior. So I've represented that diagrammatically with the red line cutting out the entanglement in the center. In the sphere case, we know that we have the modes both on the interior of the sphere. These are what I was this is what I was calling region one above, and then there's the modes on the exterior. So the decomposition is slightly more complicated. I've represented it schematically as a sum here. The K index, scalar K index is an integral, while there's a sum over J and M. And the sphere vacuum satisfies the property that it's annihilated by both the in and out annihilation operators.
Can I make a question?
Yeah. Simone is going to ask a question. I'll try and repeat it.
Just the behavior of the modes at the boundary of the diamond.
He's asking about the behavior of the modes at the boundary of the diamond. And there's a tricky thing that is not explicit here. The, when you look at the modes in region 2, there's so if we go back to slide 19, it's fairly clear that you can have arbitrary field values at sigma equals 0. So by having the arbitrary field value at the center of the diamond, these modes are going to build it up. What happens on the exterior region is that sigma sort of switches roles. Sigma tilde is 0 at spatial infinity. And so you can have arbitrary values on scry minus and at spatial infinity rather than in the center of the diamond. Yeah. The boundary of the of region 1 is sigma equals infinity. The boundary of region 2, the scry boundary of region 2, is sigma tilde equals 0. And so that means that I can put arbitrary field values at the scry, which is what I want. I want not the Minkowski, I'm sorry, I want for radiation to be able to hit the scry. So this is, these are good modes. Okay, so going back to slide 20, these creation operators create what we call spherons, fundamental excitations that are localized within the spherical entangling surface. Okay, so I've given a very sort of schematic characterization of the vacuum on slide 20. Let's make it more substantive on slide 21. Again, I can leverage the conformal symmetry, and I can find the two-point functions in my diamond region by conformally rescaling the two-point functions of the conformal metric, in this case, the FRW metric. And so you can do this for any number of dimensions. And in this way, I can extract the two-point functions both in 1 plus 1D and in 3 plus 1D. So this is a complete characterization of the spherical vacuum. And I'm going to use it in a moment, but I want to pause and look at something else first. So we'll come back to these two-point functions in a moment.
Can I just ask a clarification? The last transparency, you're referring to region 1 and region 2. And on the only figure that had region 1 and region 2 was 11, in which there were many other regions. So I think that in this case, region 2 is everything in Minkowski space outside the diamond? Or what is region 2 in the last transfer? less transparent.
Region 2 is as in slide 11. It's just the outside part there. The reason I'm only referring to Region 2 right now instead of all of the regions, which, as you say, I wouldn't in general have to include, is that I'm thinking about the Cauchy slice, which is the central lambda equals 0 slice, where the mode decomposition is particularly simple to do. But yes, I could talk about the other regions as well.
But you also mentioned that you wanted to get arbitrary data on Scry. And this you could not get unless you consider all regions, right?
Yes, I agree.
But then should not your whole expansion on slide 19 have many, many other components that you're also tracing over?
Slide 19. Do you mean on slide 20, the mode decomposition?
20, yeah, 20.
Yes, in principle, you're correct. I should include all of the regions, yes.
Okay, thank you.
A quick clarification about that. On the Cauchy surface, you only have regions 1 and 2. There's an analogous issue with region 1 and 2 in Rindler.
Yes, that's right.
Okay, thanks.
Okay, so let me move on to slide 22. So recently, several researchers working on causal sets have been investigating a very interesting state. This is the Sorkin-Johnson vacuum. So this vacuum is proposed for a causal set within a causal diamond. So the region is a similar region to ours, except it's a causal set within that region. The state is defined only with reference to the diamond's interior. It has no entanglement with the outside. And consequently, it doesn't satisfy the Riesch-Leder theorem. So let me just say very briefly what the Riesch-Leder theorem says. Intuitively, it says that if you take a nice state, say like the Minkowski vacuum, you take that state, and you act on it with operators from within a finite space-time region, with the algebra of operators from within that region, you can come arbitrarily close to any global state that you like just by using this local algebra of observables. So the reason that this Sorkin-Johnson vacuum is outside the hypotheses of the Riesch-Leder theorem is that it has no entanglement with the exterior. And so if you act up within that region with a local operator, you get something that's just contained within that region. So this is a very interesting proposal, the Sorkin-Johnson vacuum. And Afshordi et al., so there's several authors on this paper, have been investigating it intensively in the 2D case. In particular, they've been looking at it both analytically and numerically. So on the next slide, they find something surprising, which is that the Sorkin-Johnson vacuum looks very much like the Minkowski vacuum when you take the two points of a two-point function towards the center of the diamond region. But if you take the two points out near the corner, the left or right corner of the diamond region, it does not behave like the Rindler vacuum. Rather, it behaves like a static mirror in Minkowski spacetime. So I'd like to compare our sphere vacuum to this Sorkin-Johnson vacuum. And so I've taken the limits of the two-point functions that I presented two slides ago on slide 21. In the limits, I'll take just for simplicity, lambda equals lambda prime equals 0. And then I'll take the two sigmas to both be large, so they're out near the tip of the diamond. But let's say I take their difference to be fixed. In this limit, our sphere two-point functions reduce precisely to the Rindler two-point functions. And here I'm using the notation where you'll recall that L is the proper distance from the tip of the diamond. So this implies that the sphere state that we've been considering, the sphere vacuum, is not the Sorkin-Johnston vacuum in two dimensions. In particular, this will be something that's very interesting to investigate to see how these two states differ in the two-dimensional case and whether this is still true in the four-dimensional case. So let's go to slide 24. And I'm going to return to considering the Minkowski vacuum. So we've explicitly constructed the entanglement Hamiltonian for this causal diamond. And by diagonalizing it, we can recover its entanglement spectrum. But this means that I can decompose the Minkowski vacuum, this pure state, as a superposition of sphere states. I've called them I in and I out here. And this means that despite the fact that there's no in-out entanglement for this spherical region, we can recover the Minkowski vacuum through a well-tuned superposition of these sphere states. And it's this statement that I think is particularly interesting for loop quantum gravity. So on slide 25, I explain why. Spin networks are very much like this sphere vacuum in the sense that your standard intertwiner is not entangled with the neighboring intertwiners. So the node, the geometry around the node, is somehow independent of neighboring nodes. And so it's like one of these sphere states. This gives a nice way to think about what the polymer quantization of loop gravity is doing. It's sort of diagonalizing local regions of space-time. And the sphere example can provide us with an interesting guide for how we might reconstruct the Minkowski vacuum of a single node. It's like we've shown how to get the single node spin network vacuum, in a sense. But a very interesting question to me is if we have many, many nodes, which we certainly will in general, can we choreograph the entanglement between these various intertwiners in such a way that we recover the Minkowski vacuum? This might be a nice way to understand how to design the Minkowski vacuum. And I think that the reason that I've emphasized the condensed matter language throughout is that I think there's a wealth of resources that we can draw on for designing this entanglement. They've studied lattice entanglement and from a variety of perspectives, the matrix product states and projected entangled pairs, and many, many, many other points of view. So I think this is where this toy example of a conformal field theory might be able to teach us something very interesting about space-time. I've been telling you about the where, the what, the when, and the why. I need to tell you about the who. It's a very special day for me. It's my son's second birthday, and he's been helping with a lot of these calculations. So I have to send a special thanks to him for letting me come and talk to you today. So finally, I'll conclude. I think that there's a number of interesting connections to causal sets that we're poised to understand what the nature of the Sorkin-Johnston vacuum is from a continuum perspective. And in particular, as the numerical ability to understand the Sorkin-Johnston vacuum in 4D improves, we'll have interesting comparisons to make with our sphere vacuum. Our sphere vacuum also exhibits a very nice continuum example of a state that's outside the hypotheses of the Riesz-Leder theorem. So the Riesz-Leder theorem is truly a theorem, so I'm carefully saying that we're outside the hypotheses, and you may wonder how that is. The Riesz-Leder theorem assumes that you're working with a state that has bounded energy. And this thing, the spherical vacuum has an energy that diverges on the entanglement surface. So that's how we go outside of the Riesz-Leder theorem, but it's a moving around the Riesz-Leder theorem that I think is particularly interesting for loop quantum gravity. And finally, I think that we have a framework, an interesting approach for understanding how you might construct or engineer the Minkowski vacuum from entanglement by using spin network superposition. There are a number of directions that I think this research could go in that would be very interesting. More general entangling surfaces will give us a deeper understanding of the entanglement entropy and its connection with the geometry of general relativity. As I've emphasized a number of times, I think there's a lot of work in the condensed matter literature that we may be able to use here. And finally, I think that I've completely avoided the topic of anomalies, that is, times when the quantum stress energy tensor introduces a non-zero trace. And I think that would be another interesting limit to investigate here. In particular, we have some partial results in the case where the field is actually massive, and you can still think about this entanglement Hamiltonian. So anomalies maybe fall under that rubric as well. Thank you very much.
Questions?
Question here?
Yes.
Yeah. This is really just aimed at your last remark about entangling local states to get the Minkowski vacuum. Because I think condensed matter physics and quantum field theory have tools to study this, but the main tool they have we don't have, which is they have a positive definite Hamiltonian on the Hilbert space, and the Minkowski vacuum is simply the ground state of that positive definite Hamiltonian. This is a deficit that loop quantum gravity has had forever. Does your work offer any suggestion of how to achieve this? That is going to be awfully tough to engineer piece by piece and phase by phase Minkowski vacuum from the loop quantum gravity local states without some global principle like you're minimizing a positive definite Hamiltonian.
Yes. So I don't know that I have a direct attack on that issue. Only through the example of the sphere vacuum do I see that we might have an attack on it. Namely, we see that we can build up this Minkowski vacuum by properly superposing these sphere modes, even though we're not thinking of it as a minimum energy state. So we're not trying to build up the minimum energy state. We're just trying to build up a state that has a particular entanglement.
Do you think there might be a principle of extremizing some measure of entanglement that substitutes for minimizing energy?
I don't know.
Anyway, food for thought. Thanks. It was a beautiful talk. Thank you.
I don't think that there is a principle like that, right? Because after all, in Minkowski space, you could have taken some other state, few states, and still computed the entanglement entropy. And there is nothing which says that vacuum maximizes that entropy. I'm confused about a couple of points. One is if we can go back to the slide in which you are saying how one might be able to, slide 24. So I agree that you can always write Minkowski we started with Minkowski vacuum, we divide it into two parts, and therefore it is true that Minkowski vacuum can be written in those modes that you have in that equation on slide 24. But I don't understand the next line, paragraph, which says that this shows that despite of the absence of in-out and entanglement, one can recover Minkowski vacuum to a well-tuned superposition of sphere state. This is the equation that we started with, right, at the very beginning. So
yeah.
Why does this show anything?
Sorry, I didn't catch the question.
We started with this equation, right, in the very beginning. Take the system,
yes,
divide it into two parts, and then it can be written in this particular superposition with two bases, in bases and out bases. Right. So what
yes
is it that is new that is telling us that I'm missing the non-trivial content of this slide?
I think for me it's conceptual. It's the fact that we can build a highly entangled Minkowski vacuum, which has a very rich entanglement structure, out of states which have no entanglement between the interior of the sphere and the exterior of the sphere. So it makes, for me, the idea that we can construct the Minkowski vacuum out of spin network nodes much more compelling. You might worry that these nodes weren't somehow rich enough in order to construct the Minkowski vacuum. But this demonstrates a continuum example where you can do exactly that.
Okay. So is this equation that we have on page 24 any different from the Schmidt decomposition that you had on page 5? And if so, maybe I don't understand what the difference is. If you could explain that, I'll be grateful.
No, it is the Schmidt decomposition. It's the same. It's just that I'm just restating it here. So in that sense, I completely agree with you. I'm stating the Schmidt decomposition. But what I think is interesting and non-trivial about it is that I'm not using typical Riesch-Leder states to make this superposition. These are not states where I'm using localized states here to make this decomposition. And that's what I think is interesting.
Right. So, this is going back to some discussion we had about, region 2, region, various regions and so on. If I go back and take Lee's attitude that I'm just going to look at the Cauchy surface, then on the Cauchy surface, you just have a ball, which is enclosed by two spheres, and the exterior of the ball, right? So
yes,
on the Cauchy surface, I could take the Cauchy data, and that is the same as looking at the solution, and I can introduce on it a complex structure, which is like positive, negative frequency decomposition, right?
Yes.
And so these modes are providing a particular positive, negative frequency decomposition, which has something to do with this conformal killing vector idea. Is that correct?
I didn't catch the very last clause. Which has something to do with what?
Conformal killing vector idea.
Yes. So the conformal killing vector is just a nice tool for constructing these modes. The decomposition into positive and negative frequency, yes, okay, I see what you're saying. Okay, yes, the conformal killing vector plays an important role there because we're using the positive and negative frequencies of the conformally related spacetime, here the FRW spacetime, in order to understand the modes in the sphere vacuum and their positive and frequency pieces. Positive and negative frequency pieces.
All right. So therefore, is the statement then that using this In fact, there is a complex structure such that the modes inside and the mode outside are not entangled. And
yeah.
And the, okay. Thank you.
More questions?
I have a question. In fact, it's still around slide 24. You were saying something that I found surprising. You were saying that the energy of this sphere state was infinite, like the Minkowski energy of this sphere state is infinite. But that seems, surprising if you look at 24, because the left-hand side has finite energy, and then you write it as superpositions of states of infinite energy. So what? Can you say something about the energy of these states?
This is an aspect I'm still understanding in detail myself, so I shouldn't speculate too far. Right now, I've written this in as Abhay pointed out, in the general form that's the same as slide 5. But now that we have explicit expressions for the mode functions, We can explicitly find this entanglement spectrum, and hopefully achieve this decomposition explicitly and see how the cancellation works. I don't understand it in microscopic detail yet.
But I was more asking about: are you sure these states have infinite energy?
Which Hamiltonian, with respect to which, do they have infinite energy?
The Minkowski Hamiltonian.
Not the entanglement Hamiltonian.
No, they are finite energy with respect to the entanglement Hamiltonian. That's how they are constructed. But,
well, sure, but, because there's an infinitely sharp cutoff on the boundary conditions. So,
well, there's some infinity maybe. I want to know whether it really leads into infinite energy, or, you know, in a shell, you don't have infinite energy. You have an infinite energy momentum tensor, but no infinite energy. Integrate out.
My understanding of it is at the level that Lee was just saying, that it's due to this sharp cutoff on the entanglement at the boundary. How do you break the entanglement between left and right Rindler regions? You do it by putting an infinite energy on the tip between the two regions. So right now my understanding is not detailed. It's at the level of this is a cutoff that we're putting there.
Okay, but okay. Because, I mean, if you think about a shell, for instance, of course there's some kind of singularity in the energy momentum tensor, but when you integrate the energy momentum tensor, it's finite. So you should not, you know, be careful to confuse infinite energy momentum tensor, but this is different from, you know, having an infinite integrated energy momentum tensor of a finite region, because that would be very singular and thick. I would imagine.
I agree.
Okay.
But I think that I do agree that in fact the state is peculiar. That is to say, the total energy itself is infinite. That is something one can see. But if you go back to the initial data and look at the complex structure that he has actually introduced, using the sharp cutoff, you know, that in fact these modes would have infinite energy is something that follows rather quickly. You get to the point of your complex structure. Thank you.
More questions? Okay, let's thank Hal again.